Our most powerful messages come from the mess we experience. Use that stuff because guess what? Over 7 billion people in the world, chances are somebody can relate to you. If you spend so much time trying to be someone else, you'll grow deaf to the very inner thoughts you need to address and need to learn how to deconstruct. Once you've leaned into this, I promise you, and you truly own who you are, it creates the confidence necessary, the not give a blankness, I would call it if I didn't have to be somewhat politically correct on the air, to allow you to own your strengths, leverage your struggles, deconstruct your downfalls, you know, so you can prevent others from experiencing those same things. Welcome to the Art of Coaching Podcast, a show aimed at getting to the core of what it takes to change attitudes, behaviors, and outcomes in the weight room, boardroom, classroom, and everywhere in between. I'm your host, Brett Bartholomew. I'm a performance coach, keynote speaker, and the author of the book Conscious Coaching. But most importantly, I'm a lifelong student interested in all aspects of human behavior and communication. I want to thank you for joining me, and now let's dive into today's episode. All right, everybody, today's episode, finding your voice as a leader, or if you prefer it phrased the other way, finding your leadership voice. Whether your main struggle is getting your point across in a clear and convincing manner, being able to build buy-in or trust more effectively and authentically, or simply being able to get into the minds of your staff or those you lead so that you can get everyone on the same page and make better decisions together. All of those things boil down to how we communicate. Now, research makes it clear that more effective communicators see faster and longer lasting progress within their careers. And that's pan-domain. This comes as a byproduct of enhanced clarity, efficiency, and ultimately just cohesiveness when working with others, as well as you being more relatable cross-culturally. Now, the research in the medical domain is equally fascinating to me. And this is something that we've started to pick up more and more in Art of Coaching, where we do communication training, especially with so many people doing Zoom and over the internet now. We will actually work with medical practitioners at enhancing their interpersonal skills over that medium. Now, a 2002 article in the renowned medical journal, The Lancet, which I didn't know this prior to doing some research, which is among the world's oldest and best known general medical journals, states that in the course of a career of somebody in the medical field spanning 40 years, a hospital doctor is likely to do around 150,000 to 200,000 interviews with patients and their families. And that's why The Lancet says that communication is not just a leadership skill, but a core clinical skill. Guys, 150,000 to 200,000 interviews with patients and their families, and they're investing. We love working with these folks because they are invested in being better communicators. That is not an abstract term to them. They know exactly what they're getting because it's relational and educational and bridging those gaps. So I found that to be an especially fascinating statistic. But for some, I'll acknowledge this, communication can seem like a vague term, especially for those of you that have followed me since, you know, my days where I was just a strength coach, training athletes, where I spoke about programming and agility and all these things. You know, many of us, as with a lot of traditional fields, never got a lot of education on interpersonal skills. We take these things for granted. So if this seems like a vague term, you know, today and over the next few solo episodes that are going to be spread out over the next few months, we're going to boil that down a bit more. But as it pertains to this episode, we are going to dive deep on the topic many of you in our Art of Coaching podcast community on Facebook have been asking for a while. And again, that's how do I develop my leadership voice? Some of you that have been following me since day one use the term coaching voice. We will always use those terms synonymous. We believe that to be a coach is to lead, and to lead, you must coach. So if you're listening to this and you work for a tech corporation, a financial firm, anything like that, this is relatable to all leaders in every vocation. Now, when we think about these things, you have to understand that you know, there's a lot of permutations as to how this can best be done, finding your leadership voice, regardless of your age, setting, or experience level. And we're going to talk about these. But first, I want to give a quick shout out because I owe it to you, to those of you who have left reviews for the podcast lately. Curry Bird, Ed Pilgrim, Jordan Bush. There's so many of you that have taken your time, and I really appreciate it. You know, and some of you go by nicknames when you leave reviews on Apple Podcasts. But Curry, I want you to know, man, that we read this. Curry says, I've been listening to the podcast for almost a year now. Coach B seems to always have a new viewpoint, perspective, or idea that has so much merit in our day-to-day lives. Communication. It's something I've struggled with for my entire life. And hats off to you, Curry, for admitting that. That's not easy. This podcast has given me new outlooks that are helping to shape me into a better coach, friend, and ultimately a better human being. From the bottom of my heart, I want to say thank you for this information you share with us on a weekly basis. Listen, man, we love you, Curry. We appreciate that. And so many of you guys have talked about how it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what field you're in. And we've been hearing from lawyers and people in just schools and so many different fields. And that's what we want. You know, I know that we have to pick one category for this podcast in Apple, but it really is for all of you. So I want to say thank you to those of you that take the time. You know, your reviews help podcasts like this not get swallowed by an algorithm that often favors celebrity-driven podcasts or shows instead of those that are more grassroots. All right. Aside from that, now let's talk leadership voice. Now, what are people really meaning when they say this? That's what I want you to think on for a minute. What are people really meaning when they say, how do I develop my leadership voice? And the truth is, we often equate developing a leadership voice with finding ways to appear more confident and competent. I'll say that again. When people are asking, how do I develop my leadership voice? Really, we're equating that with finding ways to appear more confident and competent. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to help somebody and you're really in it for the right reasons, whatever those are to you, you're of course going to want people to be confident in your ability to help, and you want to come off competent. Otherwise, they're not going to trust you. We're not going to address people that, you know, want to be hucksters and tricksters. Like, we do enough podcast episodes on those, and these things would take an hour if we sit here and talk about every contingency. So this is for people that want to do these things the right way, okay? Now, let's talk about our voice itself, what you guys are hearing through the sound waves when I'm talking right now. Perhaps in the late night DJ FM voice or the movie theater voice brought to you by Toyota. Anything like that. When we think of our voice, that is an active form of impression management. And people will judge us to it by a degree. I mean, I had some level of hesitation about recording this episode because our son, Bronson, had been going to daycare for the first time. He got my wife sick. And those of you with kids know how this goes. Now I'm sick and I'm sitting here like, if a frog comes up in my throat or I start hacking, that's just going to sound awful. But ultimately, you know, we're pushing through and we think we'll do okay. But the bottom line is some people feel really insecure about their voice. They feel like it doesn't have the resonance, the vocal resonance, or the tonality they wish it had. And those things do influence people's perception. I won't lie. The research does show that people are attracted to certain kinds of voices. But we do not live in a world where you need to sound like Morgan Freeman, Neil deGrasse Tyson, George Earl Jones or James Earl Jones, sorry, or Patrick Stewart, right? You consider Stephen Hawking, who was diagnosed with early onset ALS, which eventually rendered him to have to speak through a computer that was fitted with a technology referred to as an ACAT or Assisted Context Aware Toolkit. Now you may think, well, okay, I'm no Stephen Hawking, so that doesn't really make me feel any better. But guys, you're missing the point. Slow down. Why do I mention this? Because when it comes to finding their leadership voice, many out there do feel insecure as to the sound. So of course it would be silly not to mention it, but I just want to assure you that is the least of your worries when it comes to this. And your actions are always going to be more impactful than whatever that tonality sounds like. Although I don't know if you saw the movie Grown Ups, I can't remember if it's one or two, where the guy comes over as a lifeguard and he's like, hey, you girls from Saskatoon, huh? And he has this super high pitched voice. Man, I've watched some bad movies. That's what you do when you have a baby and you stay up and you're just like anything to keep me awake. But, you know, besides these insecurities, there's other ways people tend to overcompensate. And that's really what we're going to focus on. We're going to get serious now. So let's divide this into three sections, shall we? And these aren't that different of how I really structured the chapters of my book, Conscious Coaching. Know yourself, know your audience, know your tactics. My whole book was predicated based off that. Why, guys? I mean, listen, The Art of War, not that dissimilar. And that's a book that has lasted a very long time. And there's a reason for that. There's distinct advantages to that level of simplicity. So to develop your leadership voice, you first need to know yourself, your raison d'etre, so to speak, right? Your purpose. Now, this means first and foremost, you need to get really clear about your core values. And I'm going to tell you, I don't really like that term. I think core values is used a lot, and I'm going to push you here because I want you to dive more deeply than saying the typical leadership stuff, family, servant-based leadership, humility, or something equally as vague and superficial. Now, I'm not denigrating those of you that say those things. Of course, those are values, honesty, humility, all these things are values, but these things are true, but you owe it to yourself to dive a little bit deeper there. Ask yourself some uncomfortable questions. For example, what lies at the heart of some of your biggest insecurities? Why would you ask yourself that? Well, it will tell you a bit more about why you tend to value the things you do or even chase the things that you do. What are you trying to prove to yourself and to others? That will highlight a little bit about what you're trying to gain. And for some of you, and myself included, when I was in my early 20s and still at points in my career now, I remember the first time working with a pro athlete, like the goal was I wanted to get respect. These guys had worked with somebody that was a legend for a long time. And I was coming in, new guy in this facility. And I knew that, they probably looked at me as a 20-year-old kid. And these guys make tens of millions. In some cases, some of them sign $100 million+ contracts. And I wanted them to feel confident. I mean, when you're leading a group of 30 plus people and you think about how much money is on the field and they've got to, you've got to get these folks right. Now, over time, that never became a worry. I don't really ever try to prove myself in that domain anymore. There were times where I'd go speak at conferences and other coaches would watch and they secretly kind of hope that you slip up. And so you might change your voice or delivery there because you have a heightened awareness. But even that, after a while, like I don't really get nervous about those things in my field or my initial field now, but I certainly did during another part of my career where, all right, now speaking for Facebook or Microsoft or Wells Fargo, going into a room and most of these people didn't even know what a strength coach was, or they think that's still what you do, or that's all you do. And what would you know about leadership? Cause they're used to this and that. And, they're so used to other people and other fields crossing over, but our field really hadn't, if you are a strength coach listening to this. So I felt like I had something to prove. I wanted to show them like, hey, on behalf of my profession, we are not a bunch of weight room junkies and idiots. We are leaders that deal with diverse personas, personalities, situations, GMs, power brokers, the same that you guys do. And while we may not work for a Fortune 500 company, you better believe we work with athletes that make hundreds of millions of dollars and a lot is on the line. So, I've always looked at the world of performance and the world of, corporation, like what they have to do on the corporate side. They're very similar. I mean, they're not all these fields, guys, whether you're a plumber and a teacher, a strength coach or a CEO, there's so many more similarities than there are differences. But I know at those points, I was really trying to prove myself to others. I felt like I had to break through and show them that I was a leader and other things, and I knew psychology, not just the weight room. Ask yourself what you're scared of losing. What are you scared of losing? Most of us are loss averse or risk averse. What are you scared of losing? Could it be, your reputation? I've seen coaches literally not teach practicals because they didn't want to be judged. And, I have a friend who's a lawyer and he talks about this all the time that people, will self-sabotage themselves even in their side of things that, because they're so scared of losing face, and that's natural, but you need to ask yourself that and answer it. What question do you go to bed asking yourself at night? That's harder than you think. Really, what do you go to bed asking yourself at night? Did you do a good enough job? Am I made for this profession? Whatever that profession is. Am I ever going to get out of this hole that I'm in my career? Will I ever, make X amount of money? Does my family think I'm doing enough? It could be anything, but I want you to kind of get dark with it. You could also ask yourself, what will you pass on? What do you really think you're going to pass on? Instead of just leaning on superficial values, what do you think you're going to pass on? I hope that I pass on the fact that, to my son, at least, that to be useful, you've got to put yourself out there. In some way, shape, or form, right? Not everybody has to have a podcast or a course or social media. That's not what I mean by put yourself out there. I mean, put work to the test, pressure test your assumptions, put yourself to the test. Like so much of life is self-discovery, and that is exactly what leadership is. So what are you going to pass on? And then also, what are your personal drives? Now, we talk about four primary drives in my online course Bought In. So I'm not going to go through those now. And we'll be unveiling a new model soon. So if you're on the newsletter, you'll definitely hear about that. But the truth is, guys, so few understand the true bedrock of why they are even trying to do what they do beyond a superficial level that it leads to them to a huge mistake. They begin mimicking others they perceive to be successful or those that have led them in the past. I mean, that was always the case in coaching. A lot of times coaches either coach like the people they worked under or the people that coach them. And so, you know, I'm telling you what not to do if you really want to develop your leadership voice. Does it mean that you can't be inspired by others? Of course not. Yeah, of course you can be inspired by others. Of course you can try certain tactics that seem to work. But I mean, we saw it all the time in our field. You know, if somebody was getting notoriety or high paying jobs because of, you know, certain motivational tactics, now everybody's trying those tactics, or it's black and white. Now, you know, now there's a war against those tactics. And we see it in other forms of business as well. People, certain companies will try to mimic the marketing strategies of other companies. But when that goes against who you are and the distinct feel of your brand or your longer, larger body of work, it's a mistake. It's a mistake. You know, people that do that crave instant respect, so they will resort to mimicry if necessary. And hey, I get it. When you have a sense of urgency about you, your hope is that you can inculcate it in others, because none of us have time to waste. But the issue is success in one domain, culture, outing, project, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have it in another, right? Whoever you consider yourself a disciple of may have acted in a different context, and you will likely find yourself in circumstances where that approach doesn't work anymore either. You don't know the whole story. You know, check the headlines in the world of sports right now, guys. In the world of sports, finance, and the like, coaches and CEOs who are using outdated or copy and paste strategies to leadership and communication are finding themselves not only ousted from their career, but also embarrassed. And for those of you that are part of the day one base that remember me just as strength coach Brett, when that was all I did before I got more and more into the leadership space, many of you, you know, denounce so many people on Instagram that are doing dumb training methods, or when ESPN or Bleacher Report shares an athlete who's doing something stupid in their strength training. And they're doing it, by the way, just to get views, guys. And coaches will share these and be like, I can't believe it. The disrespect, they're making the field look stupid. I've said this a million times, just Google strength coach fired or strength coach allegations. Google is way more impactful to the rest of the world than social media by itself is, as are a lot of these things that are going on in that field right now. It's way more embarrassing. And, you know, it's happened in larger corporations since the end of time. I mean, I don't think I really need to go into examples of fintech-like industries and things like that where, you know, all these kinds of things have happened, or, you know, on Wall Street. So this isn't new, right? So the point is mimicry may trick you into thinking you're adapting through camouflage, the camouflage of using somebody else's tactics as inspiration. But if you do that, you know, eventually don't be surprised when it's also what exposes you once your environment changes. I mean, that camouflage, you're maladapted if you're using one tactic, and these things don't fit into a vacuum. Leadership, coaching, all these things don't fit into a vacuum. So as surprising as it may sound, you'd be much better off as it pertains to developing your leadership voice, leaning into your struggle, making your mess your message. I mean, for nearly 15 years, I abstained from discussing my hospitalization, the very thing I go in depth in my book, the very thing that gave me an edge as a performance coach, and now has given me tremendous insight when working with larger corporations. Because I saw, you know, just the insidious nature of what happens when communication and interpersonal skills and the ability to get in the hearts and minds of others is not heeded, is not emphasized. Guys, you see one size fit all cookie cutter approaches that cost people more than results. It can cost them their lives and their livelihood. You know, my hospitalization and the things it opened my eyes to from a self-awareness standpoint, human behavior and social dynamics standpoint, created a cachet of new perspectives that I was able to pull from whenever I came across what might be deemed as a difficult personality or a leadership issue. Am I still learning? Absolutely. But I'm just saying that stuff, if I'm honest, gave me a little bit of a head start. Now, you know, at the time, you don't see it that way. You're 15 years old, locked in the hospital, basically for about a year in total. You know, you don't think you're getting a head start on anything, but a lot of self-awareness comes from those kinds of things. And I've talked about that before. So my point is, and you don't have to go through anything that extreme. You don't. But what I'm saying is it's those same experiences, you know, that that informed me how to coach large groups of athletes, but also the research and things that I'm doing in power dynamics, influence and behavior, and the other. It's those same kind of experiences, trials and tribulations that should inform your message, guys. You know, the bottom line is all of us commonly forget our most powerful messages come from the mess we experience. You know, that's what makes you real. It's what makes you real. And it's what separates you from pretenders or those who overcompensate. Who cares if you ran a business that went bankrupt? Who cares if you failed in your first and second job? Who cares if you failed on the national stage? Use that stuff, because guess what? Over 7 billion people in the world, chances are somebody can relate to you. So if you spend so much time trying to be someone else, you'll grow deaf to the very inner thoughts you need to address and need to learn how to deconstruct. Once you've leaned into this, I promise you, and you truly own who you are, it creates the confidence necessary, the not give a blankness, I would call it if I didn't have to be somewhat politically correct on the air, to allow you to own your strengths, leverage your struggles, deconstruct your downfalls, you know, so you can prevent others from experiencing those same things. Guys, I even experienced toxic humility. You know, I've been a part of an organization that you like almost couldn't celebrate a win, or you were looked at as an individualist versus a collectivist. And there was a good period of time where no matter what I did, I like couldn't celebrate the moment because I felt like, no, you know, it's not going to look humble, and I'm humble and I'm not happy with my own work. Like, I was almost devoid of joy from anything that I accomplished. And I still have a problem with that. But, you know, that's a whole nother thing where humility can be toxic in and of itself. And we're not going to get into that, but you have got to lean into these things. No organization ever expects perfect leaders, but they do expect those who are introspective. Finally, if you never take the time to truly deconstruct yourself and get to the core of your own weirdness, your own insecurities, your own behaviors, your own biases, then you're never going to be able to accept criticism. And how are you ever going to develop a leadership voice that's heard and respected by others if you yourself cannot accept criticism? Take a recent case study from one of our apprenticeship communication workshops. So we recently had one a little over a week ago. Don't worry, we keep them small, you know, 10 people, we have masks available, all those kinds of things. Can we get past that? All right. So we had a younger individual there who was made to go by his boss. His boss was like, we're going. And this was somebody in the physical therapy side of things, right? And I commend him because he was really honest. We asked a follow-up survey about 24 to 48 hours after to get insight as to, you know, what part of the workshop was most helpful, what wasn't helpful. We get a good amount of quantitative and qualitative data because a lot of this is tied into my doctoral work. And, you know, when we had asked what methods should not be taught or used again, he had said, and again, commend him for the honesty here. He had said, well, you know, on day one, early on, I was put on the spot. And that's a lot of what these workshops are, guys, being put on the spot, skin in the game, not death by PowerPoint. And he said, you know, essentially, I didn't have an answer for what was asked, and I was embarrassed, and that made me angry. And I, you know, I feel like I wasted part of the entire first day then dissecting everything you, he was talking to me, everything you were saying, trying to disagree with it. You know, and I found that fascinating, and that was tremendous self-awareness on his behalf. Like, he got mad because he got put on the spot, even though that this is marketed as an experiential learning skin in the game based workshop. And it very much is. And then he said basically the entire day that made him tone deaf to anything I had to say. And as a matter of fact, he was trying to pick it all apart to disagree with it. Guys, we often feel embarrassed. Oh, and by the way, there's one of those at every workshop. You know, there's one of those. Many of you, some of you listening probably can relate. If you're in a profession that's research driven, I know that we have a lot of academics that listen to this. If you don't phrase something just the right way, people are going to jump all over you, right? Even if it displays a lack of social intelligence or agility on their end, because they're missing the bigger picture, they're just going to go nuts. But the point is, we often feel embarrassed, angry, or attacked because of our ego. And that is going to blunt any attempt you ever have at building a true leadership voice. You know, our desire to be liked and seen as competent relative to our peers, that cannot drive your motivation, because your voice is just going to be, you're always going to be overcompensating. It's just going to be inaudible. And I don't mean from literally the sound waves that come out when you speak. I just mean, think about how riddled with just attitude and different emotions and contentiousness and ego and irritability you're going to come across with. Or some people don't come across like that at all, but it's very passive aggressive. They're demeaning. You know, people who are too caught up in wanting to be liked have a hard time taking feedback from others. But it's not possible to improve what we don't acknowledge. If you don't know an answer, it's okay to be like, I don't know. If you struggle with something, it's okay. We advertise our workshops as a safe place to fail. And one of my good friends, I can't remember actually, it might've been both of them, Ali Kirshner, who does a lot of our show notes, and Molly Bonetti said, well, do you think that actually, it was Molly who said it. Molly was like, do you think that scares some people away just the term failure? And I love Molly, but I'm like, Molly, I don't know. But if I have to, if saying a place is a safe place to fail so you can rehearse and refine for some of life's biggest moments and be a better communicator and a better leader, if the word fail scares them, they're not meant to be leaders anyway. And we certainly don't, you know, want them at our workshops because they're not going to embrace the experience. Guys, I hope most of you listening understand you have to fail. If you didn't, you wouldn't learn. You wouldn't learn and things would get really, really, really boring. So, you know, you need to find the objective truth in the feedback you receive and take that as an opportunity to develop further. And guess what? When it comes to communication, and I'm included in this, none of us are as good as we think we are. Pause for effect, right? Like, I'll say it again. When it comes to communication, myself included, somebody that studied this relentlessly, none of us are as good as we think we are. Should that fact keep you from coming? I'll tell you, it doesn't keep a lot of people from coming in other fields. The majority of our attendees, even when I originally started these and thinking, all right, like, you know, we'll get some of our base audience in here. We were overwhelmed with the amount of people that came from other fields and owned businesses and entrepreneurs and dentists and doctors, because these people are just over that. They're over that part of their life where they have to prove something. They just want to get better. You know, and it's interesting demographics. We've seen that, you know, one of our biggest studs in these workshops was 19 guys. And then we've had people as old as 65. The most contentious demographic we've found is about 25 to 29, or maybe 24 to 28, you know, but within there, because we find that people are, they're into their career. They're beyond the intern phase. You know, they've learned enough. They feel like they got a fresh take, but it's also dangerous because many of them haven't experienced enough life and just shit yet. I'm sorry. I wanted to be edited, but it just that, and I'm not saying all of you, you know, but many of them just haven't put themselves in enough circumstances. So they're still, oh, I'm going to prove this and I'm going to change the industry, whatever industry they're in. But that's been a fascinating thing because we found the other demographics and the more successful they are, the less reticent they are to look stupid. Now imagine that. The more successful they are in their field, as indicated by how long they've been in business, for some of our financial people, the accounts that they hold or their position at a firm or what have you, the less scared they are to look stupid or fail. Because they're just, again, no time in life to worry about that. And that's why they have a leadership voice. And that's why people follow them, because they can relate to them, right? And they're able to take that kind of feedback. So, you know, take it slow. Change does not take place in organizations or individuals overnight. You know, finding your leadership voice is a process that's going to take time. There's so much to this. So getting into our next piece, right? Knowing your audience. Here's the truth about this. Really, if I'm being honest, you shouldn't be asking how to find your leadership voice. You should be asking how to develop your leadership voices, plural. No, this isn't me selling you on schizophrenia. It's me reminding you that leadership is a skill that requires, here are some dirty words, influencing and persuading others. And the fact is that persuasive messages are more effective when they're tailored to reflect the interests and concerns of the intended audience, right? Like they've got to have a personal connection with those that you're trying to persuade. Imagine that. It's all about framing. You know, for those of you that have read my book, this speaks to the section discussing the three R's, research, relate, reframe, critical elements of buy-in. Now, for those in bought in or online course, this speaks to the influence tactics. And the play call sheet that you guys have gotten. You know, if you don't know what any of those things mean, don't worry. We're just talking about that, you know, much of the message framing literature, which dates back to the early 1900s from a research standpoint, has focused typically on the advantages of either using gain or loss frames, right? Here's what you stand to gain, right? If you become a better communicator, you stand to gain more efficiency, less stress, better relationships, more chances to have your voice heard in your organization, be perceived or be an actual leader, all these things, or loss, right? Oh, if you don't work on being a better communicator, you could lose relationships, your reputation, your credibility, your livelihood. I mean, gosh, guys, if you need proof on what bad communication can bring you, send out a tone deaf tweet and see what happens. But, you know, that's what most of the research is focused on is, you know, prospect theory to a degree, depending on the motivational orientation of the target group. Now, what does that mean? I said target group. And remember, this is also about developing your voice. We're just talking about the audience now, right? And your audience is who you're trying to influence. So keep in mind, there is a reason why in 2012 alone, more than $500 billion was spent around the world in advertising. Guys, marketing research is studied at universities. We forget this. You know, in my field that I started out in, a very traditional field, marketing is looked at as a bad word. Branding's a bad word. You're supposed to just be able to do good work and get noticed. I mean, that's a nice insight from, like, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But now we live in an increasingly populated, fast-moving, fast-paced, loud, noisy world. I'm sorry. The best work doesn't always rise to the top. You do need to understand marketing, messaging, and branding. You know, any of you that have heard my story that I've told several times on Ignaz Semmelweis, and many people throughout history know that. I wish I could tell you that even if you had something that could save the world today, you're still going to have to convince people to use it. That's just how it is, because trust is low in today's society. But, you know, when we look at these things, it's because psychological research plays such a prominent role in helping provide strategies to improve the effectiveness of any kind of persuasive campaign. And as painful as it may be for some of you to hear those words, leadership is a form of a persuasive campaign. Don't agree? Well, guys, if nobody buys into your message or is willing to follow you, your leadership voice is going to be rendered not just senseless, but silent. Of course, you're going to have to convince people to follow you in some way or another. Hopefully, it's by your actions and your words. It can be both. We want to have both. So all we're talking about here when you're developing your leadership voice is you have to be conscious of creating message-person congruence. That's the term in the research. Just saying, guys, what you say has to stick to the person that you want, that you're speaking to, right? That's a part of situational leadership. Your ability to consider contextual factors, whatever they may be, that impact the leadership process. And I'll give you one hint. I'll give you a hint on one of the most significant contextual factors: the attitudes, emotions, motives, and behaviors of others. So when I say you need to develop a range of voices, leadership voices, I'm saying that because you need to learn how to speak to what others seek in a way that they want to listen. We don't all like the same music, folks. And if you do like a wide range of music, there's probably some music you're not going to probably listen to Tupac at a dinner party. You know, you're probably not going to listen to, another form of music when you're at a lake. You're probably not going to listen to Halloween music during the 4th of July, right? Like, you've got to play the right tune for the right time. If you're a bike rider, the right gear for the right hill, whatever metaphor you want to use, right? So you don't learn this by simply reading a book or hearing about it. It takes time and immersion into the nuances of what makes all of us, well, us. I mean, think, slow it down. Think about some times where you weren't influenced by something. Somebody's trying to get you to do something, anything, guys. It could be doing the dishes, mowing the lawn, going to a conference. It could be anything at all. And you didn't listen. And then somebody told you to do it again, but in a different way. And you totally bought in. What was the change? Was it the person? Did you feel better about the person? Was it the way they framed them up? Was there an offer, an exchange, a reward of some kind? I don't know. And all of you can likely think of at least 3 to 4 instances if you really take a moment and think. And if not, you need to stop this right now and do that. You know, but as I've said before, there is no cheat sheet to this communication stuff. There's no drop-down list of scripts you can memorize or anything of a sort. And even if there was, you shouldn't want it. No craftsman wants to copy and paste. And any professional realizes that one size fits all speaks to nobody. So when people say, well, how do I craft my leadership voice, I'm like, whoa, you got one voice that everybody's going to listen to? Wow, I want to hear this voice. And I'm not that big of a smart aleck. I know what they mean, right? Like, I totally get it. And this is stuff that I just thought about more recently as I was diving into this episode. But I think you understand the irony in that now that we've explained some of that context. You know, imagine giving a rousing speech to somebody going back to emotions and things like that, who's experiencing a form of grief or fear, the same way that you speak to someone else who's experiencing a different emotion. Right? That doesn't exactly scream knowing how to read the room. You know, understanding the influence of a leader on followers, or whatever term you want to use, but the research calls it followers, right? This isn't an Instagram term, requires a higher level of understanding of drives, emotions, and moods of both parties, in addition to their actions, their cognitive kind of abilities, how they got to these decisions, right? Deductive reasoning. And even this is more complex than you think. You know, we know inherently that somebody's moods can affect the performance of individuals or groups, and leaders certainly can influence the mood of followers in various ways. You all do it every day. But do you really know how moods even vary from emotions? I know I didn't until I dove more deeply into this area. You know, emotions, if you're keeping notes at home, emotions are brief, intense reactions to an event or person, right? So that could be joy, envy, schadenfreude, elation, surprise, anger, despair, grief, right? So those are brief and intense reactions. That's emotions. Moods are longer, less intense. Longer, less intense. And they're not focused necessarily on a specific event or person. Right? There can be interrelatedness, just like climate and weather, right? Weather would be more like emotions in this case. Climate would be more like a mood. And you look at those things, but you know, an important research question in recent years through the work that I'm doing and others have done, me reading their work and trying to build off of it is more accurately phrased, is how follower moods or emotions are affected by your moods and emotions and the implications for that. You know, and that's interesting. I mean, that may not even make sense to you, but like, that's why I'm saying you've got to have different voices or different gears for the different hills, because there's so many things that are going to influence the tonality you're going to use. I mean, think how many times I've already changed my volume, my voice over the course of this episode. Consider the pauses that I use. Consider the fact that I don't really hide the imperfections. I don't ask Nate, who edits these, to edit out my cough. I'm not worried about it. Guys, I cough. Do you cough? I cough, especially when I have a cold, right? And, you know, but we try to do this so that no matter what mood you're listening in or where you're at in life, you just feel like, hey, you know, I get that the podcast and the show isn't perfect, but at least it's real. And that should fit most moods, right? People generally want things that are real. I know I do. So, you know, we haven't even spoken to biases and all the other things that make people do what they do. So to tell you, yeah, there's one voice for all these situations, that'd be dangerous, right? Just as actors and singers need range in their voices, mannerisms, and actions, so too do you. And that leads us to our next section, all right? Stay with me. We're following up, finishing up here. Know your tactics, right? Know your tactics. So what do I mean by developing voices instead of a voice? I gave you an explanation to a degree, but I didn't give you examples. For those of you who have read my book, Conscious Coaching, it could be helpful for you to think that think of these voices as archetypal personas, right? And I've talked about this ad nauseum. I mention it in the book. I mention it in our courses. Archetypes are not absolutes. They are scaffolding. They are not meant to be distinct one-size-fits-all categories. There is often interplay between them. They are nothing more than a mold, right? So you have to understand that there's interconnectedness between them, and they only tell part of the story. But archetypes, like a hero in a movie or a villain in a movie, they do exist, right? So extensions, you know, these are extensions of your true self that I kind of allow you to pick the right tool for the right job. And for the purposes of this episode, we're just going to discuss a few. If you really want to nerd out, get your butt to our workshops or subscribe to our newsletter. Maybe we'll do something on that in the newsletter. But here's the voices, right? You can choose. So if you're like, oh man, you say voices, I still don't know. I get it. Know myself, know the audience, but I still don't get how to do my leadership voice. Okay. So we have the coach voice, and I reserve the right to change these over time. The coach voice is the voice of clarity, right? It's direct yet dyadic. Dynamic too. It changes. Dyadic means there's a partnership component. Dynamic means it changes. It ebbs and flows, right? With the coach voice, you should speak with the voice of the guide, the person that helps your team stay focused on key priorities, learning new skills, all those kinds of things. There's the curious voice. Communication is all about the listener, bottom line. And as a leader, all of us have a responsibility to keep our ear to the ground as to what problems people need help with and how we can best, here's the key word, empower them to solve them. Now, notice what I said there about empowering them. You want to empower them to solve them. That's what you can almost think of the curious voice as a little bit of the Socratic method, right? Asking questions to help empower others. It's one of humble inquisition, one that wants to hear all perspectives and let their team's voice be heard. It's someone who genuinely wants to know where somebody else is coming from so they can better help negotiate internal or external forms of conflict. Can you mix and match that with the coach voice? Of course. You know, that's where strategic communication and conversational skills and ability, you know, really coalesce. There's the storyteller voice. Now, all of life is a story. Story is a metaphor for life. That's something Robert McKee once said in a book that I read, and I loved how he phrased it. It's just true. You know, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Not always in that order or cleanly, but yeah, it's got a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, and stories are the oldest and most powerful form of education there is. And there's a reason for that. It works because it's relatable. You know, stories make things stick. They can help you craft an analogy that clears up confusion. That confusion might have delayed a project, or it might drive home a complex point you have in a presentation. Effective storytellers, any way you spin it, have a deep understanding of human motivations, emotions, and drives, and they maximize that knowledge by, at the end of the day, making things more simple, relatable, memorable, right? It's almost like the taste of nostalgia every time you hear a story. And in one word, great storytellers are about connection, right? So we have the coach voice, which is a voice of clarity. It's direct yet dyadic. We have the curious voice, which is one about humble inquisition. Really, you flipping the gears and getting to know the other person, making it about them, right? And doing it in an honest way. The storyteller voice, be relatable. Drop your guard, right? Some of the best educators I've ever been around were phenomenal storytellers. They didn't need to prove how smart they were. They did that through simplicity. There's the devil's advocate voice. Man, do I use this one a good bit. Now, regardless of whether we agree with it or not, there's going to be a lot of folks that thrive on adversity. I mean, I'm one of them, and I thrive on being challenged to a degree. If it's, you know, a challenge that I'm not going to get amped up by somebody challenging me on Twitter. You know, I'll go ahead and let that person be right, because I have better ways to spend my life. But a devil's advocate, you know, if we look at the actual definition, is someone who at times may express a contentious opinion, right? And they do so typically in order to provoke debate or test the strength of an opposing view. Now, make no mistake about it. This voice, despite how, you know, the title and how it sounds, has a place in effective leadership, especially when it comes to the role of a mentor. Guys, I'm a tough mentor. I'll be honest. I'm a tough mentor. I never really had one. I had situational mentors. I've talked about this a lot, you know, but they held me accountable. I hold myself accountable, pervasively not impressed with my own work. And we live in this age of, you know, I saw somebody post this one time, and it's so true. Never before have we lived in an age where so many people pick the brains of so many experts, and you can put quotes around that or not, yet they do so little with that information. I mean, guys, it's a huge part of everything we do at Art of Coaching. Ali Kirshner and others have created podcast reflection PDFs that go with every episode of this podcast. They're absolutely free. They're absolutely free. artofcoaching.com/podcast reflections. And we still know there's a lot of people that don't download them. Now, we're focused on the people that do, you know, and I understand that everybody's going to have a reason, but we try to make sure that there's no passive consumption, or that we limit that. Our communication workshops, maybe a third of them are PowerPoint, and that's just to go over the literature. The rest of it is, you know, role-playing, evaluation, video breakdowns, case studies. Yet we will have generally one out of 10 to 12 people that will say, I wanted more PowerPoint, even though the deck has over 300 slides. Right? People just love, they just want information because it's secure. It makes them feel secure, right? So, you know, I'm a big believer that great mentors are not afraid to challenge their apprentices, as they know spoon feeding them, yeah, it might be the quickest path to short-term confidence for the apprentice, but ultimately it leads to long-term conflict or failure. You know, in other words, don't be scared to pull this voice out in the following situations, right? When your team has experienced a recent run of success and believes it's impervious to mistakes. I once sat in a staff meeting a long time ago where I heard somebody on our team at the time, and they were excited and they're a good person and all these things. So, but I'm just telling a story that said, everything we touch lately has turned to gold. Ugh, that sent shivers up my spine. I didn't like that because there was a lot that we weren't doing well. And to say something like that just conveyed an attitude of comfort, right? And I didn't like that. Now I got in trouble for that because I spoke up. When skepticism and egos are abundant, the devil's advocate voice compare nicely with the curiosity voice, right? When there's skepticism and egos, that's maybe you're taking a new job and you're going in and you have to fill the shoes of a great man or woman or whatever preferred pronoun is that left that job, right? You're going to, oh, who's this person? What are they going to do? Oh, here we go again. Right? Why I say it works nice with the curiosity voice is you can seek to understand, you know, challenge some of those things respectfully and, you know, finally seek to be understood after you felt like everybody's been empowered, right? So it can go really well there. Or when someone believes they're ready for further tests, but they're likely overlooking their own blind spots, then giving them some kind of critical way to pressure test their assumptions or abilities can be truly, truly impactful. All right, let's recap. And we're coming to the close here. We got the coach voice, the curious voice, the storyteller voice, the devil's advocate voice, and we have the educator voice. Now, educator could be looked at as synonymous with the coach voice mentioned earlier. The educator's voice leans more heavily on the analytical side, while the coach skews more relational in the long run. So certain people who overuse or misuse the educator's voice, especially if they're an analyst or something like that, may come off as dominant, when really they'd benefit more so to be seen as informed, yeah, but down to earth. You know, this voice is useful when speaking to an audience that really needs facts, hard statistics, et cetera, to be convinced. You know, the type of person who couldn't hear a story without wanting you to cite the exact variation you pulled the inspiration of that story from is the type of person who typically needs the educator voice. Now, can it be helpful in meetings, right? Such as budget proposals, right? You're educating, hey, here's what we're bringing in. Here's the cost of those things. Here's where the money's going. Here's our outlook for next year, what have you. Reviews of policies and procedures. Hey, you know, start with why. This is why we're doing these things. What we see is if we don't follow this protocol, this can happen. You know, as well as various onboarding situations, giving people clear-cut skills, guidelines, policies, procedures, and regulated boundaries. That's a great place to use the educator voice. And the final voice, well, at least for this podcast, is the comedian's voice. Now, don't let the name of the voice fool you. We're not suggesting that you start to act like a metaphorical class clown, anything but. It has to do with the fact that, you know, humor has nothing to do with slapstick behavior. It has everything to do with engagement. Research shows that the use of humor is not only the fastest way to connect with somebody, right? Humor is the shortest distance between two people, but it also enhances retention, especially of difficult skills. So humor is tremendous, but you just got to know how to use it. You know, it's not the Bare Naked Ladies song where he goes, I'm the kind of guy that laughs at a funeral. You can't understand what I mean. You soon will. Yeah, I grew up in the 90s. What up? Now, in closing, you know, it goes without saying there is a time and place where all these are best wielded, because I have to be preemptive about this, right? Because the inevitable question of, hey, you know, how do you know which one to use and when to use it and how to use it when that way and which way to use it when you're not using it and you use it? You know, asking a uniform question like that would be like asking a financial advisor for a uniform answer as to what stocks everybody should buy. And if you're like, well, financial advisor wouldn't say that, they, you know, a fiduciary or this and that, or index funds or mutual funds. Yeah. You get it. You would still need to diversify, right? They wouldn't have all of your money in one thing. You might have some in real estate. You might have some in a business. You might have some wherever. So choose whatever example you want, person that wants to be difficult. It could also be like asking a doctor what medication everyone should, you know, take if they present a certain symptom, right? Well, that's not going to happen. You don't know what the allergic reactions are. My point is, guys, nobody can tell you what voice to use because we don't know you. We don't know who you're leading. We don't know the context. If you do want to know those things, that's why we have workshops. That's why we have consults. That's why we have mentoring. So we can help the people find that who are in the thick of it and that we're engaged with. I'm just saying, I always feel like I let you down when, you know, Lead Pipe 560 DMs me and says, hey coach, I want to learn my best leadership voice. How do I do it? I'm like, I do not know you and I need more information, right? So if you've asked that question, we got to go back to step one. The answer is, of course, it depends on the context, your current skill set and self-awareness. I think I've told you guys, but if you're a new listener, one time I put out a reading list because one of the most common questions we get asked in the profession that I started out in, strength and conditioning, is what book should I read? So I put out a reading list at artofcoaching.com/reading list of the top 200 books that I thought, you know, people should read. And I got an email one day that's like, you know, hey, what, like, thanks for putting this out, but I think it's pretty silly that you didn't tell anybody what order they should be read in. And I just stepped back and I was like, huh? Like, I have no idea who you are. Wouldn't that be presumptuous and egotistical and just awful of me to say, hey, regardless of where you're from, you know, the culture that you, that resonates with you, your skill set, your questions, your struggles, your strengths, you know, just read all these and you'll be good. No, the books find you. Get started. Quit looking for those kind of lazy answers, right? So it depends on all those things. Now, all of us have a tendency to think we wield and leverage these skills extremely well. Some of you may not, but some of you certainly do, right? Like, in terms of, you think that you already are pretty good at these things. Yet the vast majority of us, like, why do you think that? Right? Like, I know until I got evaluated more in this and dove deeper into this, like, man, is that Dunning-Kruger? Right? That's a lot of overconfidence and overplacement if you think that you're already good at this. Just because you have the ability to communicate, meaning create an utterance or a sound, does not mean you are good at it. Or just because it's been part of the job you performed, it does not mean you are good at it. The majority of people have not sought out consistent and formal training in those skills, let alone evaluation. So like any skill, finding and exercising your leadership voice is an ongoing process. Don't care how long you've been in the field, whatever field you're in, new circumstances and personalities are going to test it again and again and again. But by making slow, steady steps, you're going to be well positioned to navigate these new challenges with a stronger voice. Hence what we do at our communication workshops. We have one coming up in Chicago, the weekend of August 29th. And one thing that we think makes these things uniquely special is you're surrounded by strangers. Yeah, you're surrounded by strangers, people you generally don't know, wide variety of professions. And that gives you an additional edge over those who just go to the same clinics and workshops year after year. I get it. There's great comfort in the familiar. But if you want to develop your leadership voice, coaching voice, whatever you like, you're not going to find it in the familiar. You're just going to have one song playing for the entire party, and you're basically hoping that everybody resonates with it, right? It's that this comfort in the familiar is one reason humans often flock to other people who share the same interests, you know, same jokes, hold the same political views, but familiar ground is not the best place to cultivate creativity. It's really not. And we've talked about this before on, you know, and this leads into my final tip, which is something related to what we discussed on episode 82, social capital. Homogeneous populations tend to not really create and innovate at the same level that diverse or, you know, like more diverse populations do. Now, we talked about in episode 82, you know, how that, you know, there's give and take with that. You know, America is a very, United States is a very diverse population, but there's a lot of conflict. You know, that's inevitable when you have a melting pot of so many different people from so many backgrounds and, you know, you have over 330 million with them. Like, I'm sorry, there's no way that a place like that is ever going to get along. Now, there are other places that get along great. There are nations that have tremendously homogenous populations, low crime, high happiness, but they don't really innovate. You know, there's a lot of unique statistics about how many Nobel laureates have come from America, and that's not an America is better thing at all. I've traveled over 40 countries, and I love some of them, you know, just as much. It's just saying that it's a diverse subset. I'm saying diversity wins. Inclusiveness wins. Different wins, right? That's all I'm saying. So research shows that when strangers come together, good things happen. And that means you need to get around, if you want to develop your leadership voice, you need to get around diverse social groups if you want to spark one of the best leadership skills there is, divergent thinking. You know, I once got told by an acquaintance, he goes, hey, you know, you and I are very different, but I appreciate you. And I was like, what the hell do you mean by that? And I said, well, you should appreciate me because I'm different. Like, do you just want people that are like you to be around you all the time? You know, so like when we developed this, our workshops built off what was known as the edge effect. Now, what is the edge effect? In the 1930s, don't worry, I'm not going to go into a diatribe here. A gentleman named Aldo Leopold wrote about the fact that life essentially thrives in areas where two different ecosystems come together. And this is the apprenticeship communication workshop to a T. It's why, you know, I've been able to find some relative success coming from the performance side of things into the corporate world, because there's a lot of management of egos and high stakes and all these things. And you got to communicate with a wide array of people from various backgrounds. But so we think of this where two different ecosystems come together. This could include the shore, you know, of an ocean, or the border of a forest and a marshland where they meet. You know, it's what's called an edge effect. And this also applies to ecological succession, which is when vegetation spreads rather than losing to its competitors. The point being, guys, is in areas where these two different ecosystems come together, you often see those kinds of species evolve and thrive at different rates, higher rates, right? There are different species that are suited to either the edges or more centralized sections, just like certain people are probably better suited just going to the same workshops. They're probably suited because they don't want different. They may say they're lifelong learners, but they really don't want to be tested. Those people aren't the kind of people we really look for at Art of Coaching, right? There are some animals that travel between habitats and others that are restricted to others. But when you look at the edge effect, that's what we try to build off of. You know, when you want to develop your voice, you have to challenge yourself, right? You have to think about creating an atmosphere that attracts diverse voices, various professions, and inspires collaboration that helps all of us, including me, when I'm teaching these workshops, uncover new solutions via lateral thinking. It's crazy to me that people act like this lateral thinking is a new idea, right? Ever since a book came out that started talking about this more. Guys, it's been going on since the dawn of man. Get around different people. Tribes learn from other tribes. People, I mean, we see babies that learn to crawl faster sometimes if, depending on, there's some other factors here, but like if they see crawling or they have brothers or sisters performing certain activities, that exposure to those different things that they cannot currently do helps, right? And they're in the same family. So how do I relate that? You don't have to be in the same field or at the same level, but you can be in the same family of people that want to help others succeed and be better. So, you know, if you want to develop your voice, get beyond the accepted explanations, and you need to embrace trial and error, right? To truly become someone who embraces trial and error, you have to be willing to put yourself in vulnerable positions. And only through putting yourself in vulnerable positions again and again will you develop your leadership voice. That's it. And that's it for the episode of this episode of the Art of Coaching podcast, guys. To learn more about our online courses, live seminars, and the abundance of free resources we have, go to artofcoaching.com. I'm grateful to all of you. I really do mean that. And I hope that you have an excellent day whenever you listen to this. Our podcast reflection worksheets are made by Ali Kirshner. Podcast is produced by Nate Fisher. Thank you to Gary Uchol, HBR, Jacob Hirsch, and Galen Bodenhausen. Sorry if I mispronounced that, for your supporting research. And most importantly, guys, please, if you know somebody that's struggling developing their leadership or coaching voice, pass this along. You know, I did a lot of research for this because when I look online, there's just a lot of vague stuff, And I wanted to create something different from you. So I know it's technical. I know it's deep. I know for some of you, it can be hard to follow. That's okay. But I want to give you something meaningful and useful. I don't want to just say, oh, know your core values, trust in yourself, and pay it forward. Okay, cool. Until next time, guys, Brett Bartholomew, Art of Coaching Podcast. Take care.